Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Hope you all had a great Thanksgiving break. Today's episode is a great one. I'm speaking with William D. Cohen about his book, Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. The book is basically a corporate autopsy, as William puts it, of General Electric. Folks remember back in June, I did an episode with the New York Times' David Gelles. We spoke about Jack Kemp, the most famous CEO of GE. So it's great to double down on this story and really fits into our recent theme and coverage of industry and what happened to America during the 20th century. If you're interested in business journalism, if stories like the fallout from the FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried scandal are relevant to you, this is a great conversation that fits into that theme. Quick couple of notes before we get into this episode. Number one, there is a link in the show notes to the Realignment Conference that is going to happen in Washington, D.C. on January 25th, 2023. So if you'd like to hang out with Sagar, me and Sagar in person, you should definitely go check the conference out. It's going to be a really great time. We're going to cover the future of the American right and American politics moving into 2023. Secondly, we are moving into 2023. So with that, we've got the final month of shows. As you guys know, I'm doing this intensive daily episode period. We're going to cover all the big topics that you guys are going to hear going into the end of the year. If you want to send your suggestions, email realignmentpod@gmail.com. Guests, topics, focus areas, anything is up for grabs. And then, of course, if you enjoy this content and you want to support the hard work of putting out those daily episodes like the Ukraine series, you should go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. It's how we support the show, do all that great stuff. Hope you all enjoy this conversation, and we will see you all later this week. William Cohen, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me, Marshall.
I want to start with a question that I think will level set for folks, even if they aren't deeply invested in the story of GE. It seems like right now we're in this period in the American business world where narratives are just shifting rapidly. SBF is the hero, he's the savior, he's above board, and it actually turns out he's not. Insert Elizabeth Holmes reference. Next Steve Jobs, now going to prison. And in the case of GE, when I was growing up, 1990s, 2000, this is just like a, in its prime company, American innovation. And then we discover via books such as yourselves, that actually GE was not doing as well as one would think it was. And now today, it's sort of being sold off for parts. So do you think there's something to this idea that right now we're in this golden age of business narrative resets, or is that just kind of like a presentist bias? And actually during the 70s, 80s, 90s, everyone's always kind of screwing around.
Well, there was a famous, I believe, Austrian economist named Joseph Schumpeter, who wrote about creative destructionism, and you know that the seeds of a company's destruction are planted, early on, and it's just a question of time before they grow into full-blown, oaks that take the company down. I mean, I think Jeff Bezos once told the troops at Amazon that it's just a matter of time before Amazon disappears and is no longer, and so their job is to try to stave off the inevitable destruction of the company as long as possible. So, companies have been going in and out of business forever. That's probably the rule, not the exception. Wall Street has always been a dangerous place, and people forget that. I mean, there used to be, thousands of brokerages, firms, for instance. I mean, I remember once upon a time when the Wall Street Journal would publish full-page ads called tombstone ads, appropriately enough, which sort of heralded, a recent big, debt or stock underwriting. And then it would list all of the underwriters on the page, from the biggest to the smallest, you know, going from the upper left to the lower right. And then sometimes, you know, like a big offering would have 100+ underwriters. Now they don't even do those ads anymore because, you know, there are so few underwriters left that it would be obvious to everybody that that Wall Street has become an oligopoly, a cartel. And that's not the kind of advertising that, you know, Wall Street wants people to focus on. So, you know, this has been happening for a long time. But yes, there have been a lot of strange things recently. So I do agree with that. I mean, you know, in the space of, you know, 3 weeks, you have, you know, supposedly the world's richest man, Elon Musk, you know, closing on his ridiculous deal to buy Twitter, and then having a combination of financial calumny with operational calumny, and, you know, a potential disaster, you know, a $44 billion disaster is in the offing. And then the next week you have supposedly the richest guy under 30, SBF, you know, who seemed like a crazy, you know, but, you know, mini, you know, Albert Einstein. Next thing you know, he's blowing up his company and people are like scratching their heads like, you know, how the hell did that happen? So you have like the world's richest guy and the world's richest guy under 30, you know, in the process of blowing up their companies, you know, within weeks of each other. Very odd.
You know, I want to play around with the Schumpeter reference of this idea of seeds eventually transforming into or growing into the oaks that destroy a company. So in Power Failure, you're telling a 100-year-plus history of GE, and especially in a couple of the book reviews, there's this discourse around, is it Jack Welch's fault? Is it Jeff Immelt's fault? But to a certain degree, especially regarding the financial chicanery and kind of the priorities of the firm, could one argue that those seeds were planted maybe in the 19th century or the early 20th century? Like, where would you see the seeds metaphor applying to GE?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you could argue that the myth started getting created right from the start. You know, myths are, of course, not the same as the seeds of destruction, but, you know, they're a first cousin, perhaps. So, you know, the first myth, of course, about GE is that it was, you know, created by Thomas Edison. I mean, you know, that's a great story to tell because, of course, Thomas Edison is supposedly one of America's greatest inventors. And if he, you know, created GE, then therefore, you know, you can't have a better DNA strand in your history than Thomas Edison. Unfortunately, as I discovered in researching this book, it's not true. You know, Thomas Edison created a company called Edison General Electric that was one of several companies that provided the technology to create electrical power. And then creating the grids under which that electrical power could be delivered to customers. I mean, you have to remember there was a time when there were no electric grids, let alone, you know, sources of electricity. And so not only did you have to, you know, come up with the technology that created electricity, you know, in a form that wasn't just, you know, Benjamin Franklin holding a kite with a key on the end of it, you know, and waiting for lightning to strike. You then had to create the grid to deliver that power to customers and convince them that it wasn't going to like blow up their business, literally and figuratively. Fires were set as a result of these electric grids. So it took a while for that to all kind of work its way out. But, you know, Edison created Edison General Electric, and he got as his venture capital investors, you know, J.P. Morgan, the man, and Henry Villard, who was a venture capitalist, who then became a railroad industrialist. But by the time of the 1890s, was the CEO of Edison General Electric, with Thomas Edison sort of being, you know, on the board and a shareholder, but, you know, sort of moving on to other things. Then there was this guy named Charles Coffin, who grew up in Maine and then moved to outside of Boston to Lynn, Massachusetts, to take over his to work for and then take over his uncle's shoe business, shoe manufacturing business. He decided, you know, he wanted to get into a sexier business. And so he ended up buying this company that made, you know, a similar product to Thomas Edison's company out of bankruptcy and moved it up to Lynn, Massachusetts, and then actually did a pretty damn good job of providing electric power and the grid to, you know, New England. And then that company was backed by a bunch of venture capitalists in Boston. And then, you know, in 1892, they decided to merge the two companies, with Coffin's company being the far more successful company, not Edison's company. Edison opposed the merger. He didn't want anything to do with it. He thought it was a terrible idea. But J.P. Morgan and Henry Villard did it anyway without him knowing. And that reduced him down to becoming a very minor shareholder, which he then sold his stock and moved on. And the new GE became the CEO of the new GE was Charles Coffin. And then just to, you know, fully answer your question, literally the next year, 1893, that was 1892. 1893 was a major financial crisis in the country, and GE almost went out of business and ended up having to, it had too much debt. I think it had like $10 million of debt, which was too much at that time. Seems laughable now, but whatever. And it ended up having to buy back its debt at a discount, with the final approval coming from J.P. Morgan, the man who was, you know, up at his, you know, lodge in Maine and sort of incommunicado. And they were sort of waiting on his decision. GE was teetering on the edge. And then he finally gave his decision that, you know, they would put money in to make it possible for GE to buy back its debt at a discount. So that, you know, that was the talk about origin. I mean, that could have resulted in no GE very quickly, as opposed to a 130-year GE that took 130 years for it to end up sort of getting back to where it could have been in 1893.
So the key thing then is this myth that the cousin of the seed is that there is almost inherently in GE's DNA, this spirit of innovation, this ability to move into different markets, kind of in the way that you would think of Thomas Edison is doing. To what degree then is GE then at its peak? Like when would you say is peak GE? Like when is when's the best confluence between that idea of Edison's company and the American century and inventing all these different technologies? What's the peak?
Well, I mean, we being Americans, we tend to like to keep score by looking at stock prices and stock market value. So then, I, you know, if that were the case, then, you know, the peak was probably, you know, August 2000 when GE was worth about $650 billion, the most valuable company in the world. You know, when Jack Welch took over GE, it was, you know, a very highly respected, longstanding, innovative, technologically advanced company, sort of the, you know, not only the creator of the light bulb and the electric grid, but the jet engine. It was one of the first manufacturers of electric cars and X-ray machines and, you know, to say nothing of, you know, sort of a leader in providing, you know, all those major appliances that we take for granted, whether air conditioning or refrigerators or whatever, television sets, you know, you know, sort of you name it, it was ubiquitous. But it was also, you know, an important, but, you know, a relatively benign company, if you will, although there was a time when it created manufactured nuclear power plants, and it was a big supplier to the military industrial complex. You know, it but you know, when Jack took it over in 1981, it was worth about $12 billion. So he took it from $12 billion to $650 billion, which is, you know, a pretty major accomplishment. You know, Tim Cook took Apple from $300 billion to $2.5 trillion that it is now. Tim Cook has probably created more shareholder value than anybody in the history of the world. You know, at first time, Jack was the Tim Cook, I guess, of his age. I mean, Jack had created more shareholder value than anybody else, because GE was the most valuable company in the world. It was the most respected company in the world. Jack Welch was, you know, named the manager of the century by Fortune magazine. So in the 20th century, you know, so I would say sort of right at the time that Jack was getting ready to leave GE, you know, GE was at its peak.
And this is where I'm interested in your answer as a chronicler of the history here. You kind of hinted at this with, you know, Americans liking to keep score via the stock market. And obviously there's this big debate about shareholder primacy. And is that really like the best marker? When would you say, separate from the stock price question, GE was at its most innovative and truly kind of era defining? Because the GE of 2000, especially considering where GE is today, obviously wasn't the GE of, let's say, the 10s or 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Like, when would you say, like, from your personal perspective, GE is at its most compelling?
I mean, you know, I think it's a good question, but sort of a hard question to answer because, you know, it depends, you know, what your perspective is, you know, where you stand depends on where you sit. You know, what's important to people at a given period of time. I mean, obviously, you know, in the 1890s, you know, electricity and electrical power, you know, and replacing candles and whale oil, you know, in your people's homes and heating their homes by electricity, all those things were very important. So, you know, right from the bat, GE was a, you know, a technological a leader, you know, and, you know, creating, you know, if you watched that, you know, stupid show on HBO, you know, The Gilded Age, you know, I think in one of the early episodes, there was a scene where everybody was sort of congregated for a big, exciting event in Lower Manhattan when they were lighting up this, you know, couple of blocks of Lower Manhattan for the first time. And it was a big event, and all of high society in New York was there. And that was GE lighting up, you know, the electrical grid in Lower Manhattan. It also provided, you know, electricity for the subway system in Manhattan, and then all of New York City. I mean, you know, it was a pioneer in the creation of electric cars, you know, more than 100 years ago. But of course, you know, back then, electric cars, you know, had many of the problems they still have today, which is they, you know, the batteries do not last for very long before they have to be recharged. And then along comes, you know, Henry Ford once worked for Thomas Edison on electric cars. But then Henry Ford, you know, came up with, you know, then oil and gasoline was discovered, and it was much cheaper. And, you know, the combustion engine replaced the electric engine. You know, what's a jet engine? A jet engine is really just a big power, you know, plant turned, you know, in a different direction, right? I mean, it's just a huge source of, and GE is still the leader in, you know, in jet engines and in innovation in jet engines. It's creating a jet engine that, you know, relies on hydrogen, which is an abundant source of energy and relatively, you know, pollution free, or electric engines that run on planes. You know, these medical equipment and devices we take for granted, starting with the X-ray machine and moving into the MRI machine and the CAT scan and all that. All of that is GE. GE created these huge locomotive engines that run trains all over the world that we, you know, take for granted, or did. I mean, you know, now the whole company is, you know, splitting up and dissolving. You know, so the height of its technological power, I mean, in many ways, it's always been a technological leader. I mean, I think what happened, of course, is that GE's technological and industrial prowess made it a not only a leader in the stock market, but a leader in the credit markets. And it had a AAA credit rating. And then Jack Welch came along and decided that GE Credit, what became GE Capital, could be a source of huge profits for GE because he could arbitrage GE's AAA credit rating, you know, borrow really cheaply, you know, like the, you know, about what the U.S. government pays to borrow, and then lend that money out, you know, very expensively to companies that couldn't get financing elsewhere. So, you know, GE Credit started very practically in the Depression as a way to provide financing for people who wanted to buy GE's products, like dishwashers and washing machines and refrigerators, and couldn't afford them during the Depression. So GE would finance them. And over time that evolved, that was a relatively small business until Jack decided when he was running that business, you know, in the late 70s before he became CEO, that he could arbitrage GE's AAA credit rating, borrow very cheaply, and then lend that money out, you know, dearly. And at one point, GE was the largest issuer of commercial paper in the world. So commercial paper is, of course, inexpensive, cheap, short-term, inexpensive, unsecured financing. You know, that at one point, you know, over time, GE Capital became, you know, as much as 40% of GE's earnings, and then under Jeff Elmo, 50% of GE's earnings. I spent 2 years at GE Capital from 1987 to 1989 after I got out of business school. And, you know, I was financing leveraged buyouts. I'd been a former journalist who went to get my MBA at Columbia and went to Wall Street and was financing leveraged buyouts. How absurd is that? But that gives you a sense of sort of the freewheeling, entrepreneurial kind of exciting nature of what GE Capital was doing to make, you know, a ton of money. And that helped GE achieve its earnings every quarter. And when Jack Welch told Wall Street analysts that he was going to make a certain amount of earnings every quarter, having all these billions and billions of assets at GE Capital helped him to do that. And that gave him a lot of respectability on Wall Street, which helped the earnings grow, which helped the stock price increase, which became a virtuous circle, you know, until basically it kind of began to fall apart, you know, 4 days after Jeff Immelt took over GE. Jeff Immelt became the CEO of GE on September 7th, 2001. And then on, you know, September 11th, 2001, the world changed.
What do you think of then? So two questions here. I'm interested in your thoughts on Fortune or Forbes, one of the two F business publications, labeling Jack Welch the manager of the century. Like, what do you think about that designation 20 years later? And then it's also just interesting to use the word manager in the CEO sense, because it seems that especially post 2008 financial crisis, where tech becomes a bigger centerpiece of the American economy, I don't think Elon would want to be known as like a great manager. You know, Mark Zuckerberg would not be thought of as like as a great manager. Seems like a CEO today at their best is more visionary in terms of what they're actually doing. So what do you think about those two dynamics together?
Well, I always thought it was kind of strange that I think it was Fortune that named him manager of the century as opposed to CEO of the century, you know, because of course he was a CEO. You know, I don't know what kind of message they were trying to convey by that, but he, you know, I would say he was also a great manager in the sense of managing people, inspiring people, getting them to overachieve, getting them to work harder than they normally would. You know, for a long time, GE was considered like, you know, management central, right? I mean, just creating one great CEO after another. And it's, you know, there's still, you know, sort of the GE Jack Welch coaching tree is still, you know, populates American capitalism, you know, to this day. And you know, of course, the irony of that, much of that would happen at Crotonville, their management training center up on the Hudson River, which they just announced that they're putting up for sale. You know, I think Jack really inspired people. I mean, everybody that I mean, obviously, when I was working there, he was, you know, considered like a deity. And he hadn't even achieved, you know, by the time I left in 89, what he would achieve, you know, a decade later. And I think, you know, that there's a lot of revisionist history going on now, you know, regarding Jack. You know, David Gelis wrote this book.
Previous podcast guest to note for listeners, but we'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, he wrote the book, The Man About Jack, The Man Who Broke Capitalism. Now, I like David. I've met him a couple of times. You know, I respect what he does at the Times. I don't understand that book. I confess I didn't read it because I didn't want that in my head as I wrote my book. But, you know, I spent hours interviewing Jack. And many, many more hours interviewing people who worked directly for Jack. And then I spent, you know, months, you know, researching GE, you know, the whole history, including obviously the period when Jack was CEO. And I worked there for 2 years. So I felt like the thesis of his book made absolutely no sense to me, The Man Who Broke Capitalism. Now, I don't believe it's true. I don't believe capitalism is broken. I mean, is capitalism broken? I mean, it's a nice thing to debate, you know, and I'm sure, you know, progressives, you know, on MSNBC can, you know, go crazy for that topic forever if they were given a chance to do that. But I mean, you know, that's absurd. Obviously, a capitalism is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, you know, it may be have huge flaws, but it's also the way the world works at this point. You know, we'd have none of the things we take for granted if it weren't for, quote unquote, you know, capitalism. And there's lots and lots and lots of things we take completely for granted that would, you know. So I don't agree with the premise that.
So quick thing on that, then. I think having read the book and interviewed David, I think what one could say, aside from your point that the word capitalism is misapplied, let me say, I think the fair reading would be that Jack Welch's tenure at GE introduced longer term negative dynamics to corporate America, restructuring, mass layoffs, financialization, preferencing that, you know, 2000 stock price over whether the company was actually internally healthy. What do you think about, I think, that little more nuanced articulate? I agree with your point about the title being overwrought, but what would you say to those specific points?
I don't actually agree with that. I mean, you know, the SEC, I mean, I don't know when the requirement for quarterly reporting was instituted by the SEC, but the SEC came about during the Depression, right? So, I don't know when the idea of quarterly reporting came in. Maybe that was the way it was from the start. I just don't know. But it certainly wasn't created by Jack Welch. You know, Jack Welch was the CEO of GE, and GE was obligated, as every publicly traded company that is registered with the SEC is required, to report quarterly. You know, in the UK, they report every 6 months for some reason. Here, we report quarterly. So every company has to report earnings quarterly, and research analysts cover a lot of companies, not all of them, on Wall Street, especially the big ones. So GE is, you know, had a massive following among stockholders, retail stockholders. You know, it was an original member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's been around, as we talked about, since 1892. I think it's been public since 1892. You know, so it is always being, you know, watched very carefully by Wall Street, by retail investors, by pension plans, the endowments that own the stock. So, you know, Jack, like every CEO, and being the CEO of GE, it was only a heightened responsibility, had the responsibility to report earnings on a quarterly basis. And the convention, for whatever reason, became sort of giving an indication of what a quarterly profits would look like in advance. And then if you missed them, you know, then you were vilified and deified and the stock cratered. So Jack took very seriously his responsibility of making the quarterly numbers that he told analysts he would make. Now, he was lucky. Now, you may call it the financialization of America, but that did not. He had GE Capital, you know, in his stable. He could, you know, sell a loan. He could sell warrants. He could sell a building, you know, that GE had owned or financed, you know, to get profits to, you know, make sure he made the numbers that he promised that he would make. A lot of people think that was, quote unquote, manipulating earnings. I think it was just being a responsible CEO who promised investors that he would make a certain amount of earnings and then achieving them. Because the opposite of that, failing to do that, was, you know, beginning, sort of the start of a devastating pattern that could result in, you know, people losing a lot of money and him losing his job or whatever. So, you know, that did not start with Jack Welch. The financialization of America did not start with Jack Welch. You know, he was as clever as many people have. I mean, look, his ride as CEO corresponded nicely to, you know, a huge bull market beginning in 1982. But, you know, he realized that GE, you know, he was selected as the CEO because he wanted to, you know, revolutionize GE, and, you know, it had become staid and bloated. And, you know, he told Reg Jones, his predecessor, that he intended to sort of blow up what Reg had created. And so that meant, you know, getting rid of the bloat and layers of bureaucracy.
Was it the quote from that the previous CEO said, "I'm offering you like the Queen Mary"? He said, I want to turn this into a speedboat. Yeah. I like that right. quote.
Yeah. And so the way to do that is, you know, look, this is, you know, if you want, it's very Darwinian. I mean, you know, it's, and it has its downsides. And it, I mean, I don't mean to, you know, I've certainly been the victim of Wall Street's busts and booms. You know, I got fired from my job at JP Morgan Chase in 2004 for no reason whatsoever, other than, you know, I was, you know, old and in the way. And that, you know, then I became a writer. So, you know, capitalism is a tough taskmaster. I mean, you know, it's rough, and maybe there's a better system out there, and maybe we should conceive of it, and maybe we should, you know, the 9 billion people on the planet should do everything in their power to throw off the chains of capitalism and try something else. But as far as I can tell, there isn't a replacement for it yet, and nor is there anything that anybody seems to be championing that people are adopting and is a better way to go about it. I mean, capitalism is very, Darwinian, but it's also very good at allocating capital and labor to where it can have its best, highest and best use, and, you know, return, invest or get a return on investment for the people who take the risk of providing that capital. And creating a lot of wealth, maybe too much wealth in the hands of some people, yes. But generally, more people have sort of risen out of despair and, poverty as a result of capitalism than any other system. So until we come up with something better, that's what we got. And Jack didn't create it, and he didn't break it.
You know, here's what's interesting, given, I'd say, the helpful revision is you're kind of revisioning the revisionist history, right? Like, so we're kind of going in a circle back to.
The research. David Gelis didn't do the research. He had a thesis that, he wrote down a polemic for whatever reason. And I'm not sure why he did it. I haven't talked to him about why he did it. But I just think it was completely flawed. I mean, I think if you're a journalist, which David Gelis is, and I don't mean to, attack him in any way, but I mean, if you're a journalist, you can't write writing, you can only write reporting. You know, I mean, I could have gone off and said, you know, Jack Welch, you know, was the worst, you know, thing since sliced bread, but that's not what the reporting bears out. The people who worked for him loved him. The value of the company, which is, you know, the way we measure these things, you know, get me a better way to measure. You know, went from 12 billion to 650 billion. He was the company was the most respected. He was the most respected CEO. It was the most valuable company, the most innovative company. It was like, you know, Google, Apple, Microsoft, you know, all rolled up into one for a time being. And, you know, I think it's fun and intellectually stimulating to, you know, we love in this country to build up our corporate leaders, our politicians, and then we love nothing better than to tear them down. We do it all the time. We've been doing that for generations. So, you know, Jack Welch was ripe for a takedown. You know, I don't want to be the one defending him necessarily. I just want to be the one sharing with people what the reporting actually shows and the research.
So that's it. So you wouldn't say then, do you have a thesis then for this book, or it's a story? Do you know what I mean?
It's like a story. It's narrative story. Nonfiction. It's, yeah. Like the question I was trying to answer is, there's a dead body on the ground. How did it get there? You know, which is the same thing I tried to answer when I wrote my book about Bear Stearns, when I wrote my book about Goldman Sachs, when I wrote the book about the Duke LaCrosse case. What really happened and why? Well, I can find that out. I know how to do that. I can go and interview as many people as possible. I can go to the documentary evidence. I can go to the historical evidence, the journalistic evidence. I can assemble it all, synthesize it all, and figure out what really happened. That's my job as a reporter and a writer and an author, you know, and it's 800 pages. So, you know, I think I did my job. And, you know, it would have been far easier to say, you know what, time to take down Jack Welch. Let me just do that in a polemic way and put a fancy, you know, a title on the book that'll get clicks and, you know, do that. But, you know, that's not what I want to do. That's not what I do.
I'm curious then for your thoughts on business journalism today. Obviously, a lot of folks are bandying about the, I can't, once again, was this Fortune? Was this Forbes? Sam Bankman-Fried? Is he the next Warren Buffett? Do you have what would just be your assessment of that space, considering these big stories we mentioned at the top? Is this just complicated? Are people sort of moving beyond their lanes to a certain degree? Forbes' job is to put people on covers. So I'm not going to really treat that as the dunk that people could maybe do. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Every magazine that is still printed, you know, a diminishing number. You know, obviously Vanity Fair is not anything like today, the Vanity Fair that I used to work for 13 years. You know, there's a cover. People have to put things on the cover. And they like to put the latest shiny object on the cover. And what could be a shinier object than Elon Musk or Sam Bankman-Fried? I mean, it's just like a printed version of clickbait. They sell, you know, they put people on the cover so they can sell the magazine. I know that's a cliche. And of course, there's much more to it than that, of course, because it's not just the cover. But, you know, what's going to sell more magazine? If you compare Sam Bankman-Fried at 29 years old to Warren Buffett at 91 years old, when, you know, Warren Buffett has had, you know, some 60 plus more years of experience and lived experience and proven success year after year after year through cycle after cycle after cycle. You know, why are you doing that? You're doing that because you're sort of posing an exciting and intriguing question that you hope people will be motivated to buy the magazine and read the story. Or click on the story or whatever it is. And so, I mean, it's just amazing how often these business publications just get it wrong and miss the boat completely. But, you know, in fairness to them, it's hard to do it kind of in real time. It's easy, you know, in hindsight. You know, there are people who saw, you know, the 2008 financial crisis coming. And my friend Michael Lewis wrote a book about that. And now he's going to write a book about, I assume, about SBF. And so, you know, that'll be a great success for Michael, and he deserves it. And, you know, he's at the right place. He has a knack for being at the right place at the right time. But, you know, what I mean, the same thing happened with GE, you know, lionizing these guys. They're constant. I mean, the number of Harvard Business School cases about GE's, you know, industrial and financial prowess are legendary. Has there been a Harvard Business School case about the destruction of GE? No, of course not. They, you know, there should be a Harvard Business School case literally encased in glass about how, you know, which is, you know, what my book is about, you know, how GE, you know, all fell apart.
I'm curious then, because I want to go back to this idea of folks building up and tearing down. As you're telling this history, as you're telling this story, to what degree is the blame game useful, necessary, kind of missing the point? Because to your point, you referenced this, right? Like, you know, Jack Welch takes over during the bull market. You know, Jeff Immelt takes the reins 4 days before 9/11. If the timing's been entirely different, it's easy to see a world where we'd be talking about some other CEO. There are a bunch of CEOs that Jack Welch was, or pre-CEOs who Jack Welch was competing against. How do you think about this debate over, is it Jack Welch? Is it Jeff Immelt? How do you think about that?
You know, I had a piece in the Times yesterday where, you know, I wrote about the importance of the selection of the CEO. And one thing Jack told me when we first met in August of 2018, so, you know, not that long ago, and, you know, after Jeff Immelt had been replaced as the CEO, that he had, you know, fucked up, was his words, in the selection of Jeff Immelt as his replacement. You know, but I said, Jack, you selected him. So, you know, isn't that your mistake? And of course, you know, he owned up to it. It was his mistake, and he was taking responsibility for it. You know, he didn't see it at the time. You know, did Bob Iger see at the time that Bob Chapek was the right guy to succeed him or the wrong guy? I'm sure at the time he thought he was the right guy. And then pretty quickly he decided he was the wrong guy. And then 2 years later, he's out and Bob Iger's back. Now, that didn't happen at GE, but I would say that, you know, Jack told me that, you know, it was like 7 years in before he realized that he had made a mistake with Jeff. You know, and at a company like GE, unfortunately, you know, you're not going to correct that mistake quickly. You're not going to do it like Disney did. I mean, obviously, you know, maybe if it happened today, you'd do it. But, you know, look, they've had their new CEO, Larry Culp, since, you know, October 1st, 2018, 4 years, and he's done nothing. The stock price has done absolutely nothing. He took the previous CEO, John Flannery's idea of breaking the company up, and, you know, is in the process of implementing it, claiming that as his own intellectual capital, which it wasn't, and, you know, taking for himself a $100 million windfall, as well as 4 years of contracts that no other GE CEO had. But he really hasn't done anything for shareholders. And, you know, he's still there. Nobody's talking about getting rid of him, although they are talking about, you know, splitting the company up, and they will split the company up. So, you know, the blame game is like a fun thing. I mean, you know, I did this corporate autopsy. Obviously, I think I, you know, succeeded in figuring out, you know, who's responsible and what happened every step of the way. I mean, Jeff Immelt was there for 17 years, so he gets the lion's share of the blame, and I think he knows it, and can almost take responsibility for it. He doesn't quite do that either in talking to me or in his own book. He tries, then he
did
gets
you read
sort
his
of
book?
The way that, oh, of course, yes.
What did you think of the book?
Well, as I say, I think he, you know, tried to take some of the blame for himself, but he was also quick to blame others by name, which sort of surprised me, because when I would talk to him before the book came out, when we would get to somebody he was not feeling particularly kindly about, he would insist that what he was going to say about them was off the record. So, of course, I had to respect that. But then in his book, he named them and shamed them. And I thought, oh, thank you, Jeff. I'll just quote from your book now. So he was not shy about blaming others. You know, he also tried to convince me over and over again that he had kept the best people around him and he didn't lose people. But in fact, if you look at the evidence, he lost a lot of talented people, mainly because he pushed them out, because he didn't, you know, they would try to make an argument to him and he wouldn't listen to them, and he didn't want somebody who wasn't, you know, on the team and rowing in the same direction. You know, he didn't want to hear from dissenters. And so he lost a lot of talented executives that way. The truth is that Jack made mistakes. He admitted mistakes. He was willing to listen to dissent. Objectively speaking, going from $12 billion to $650 billion is, you know, what we reward CEOs to do. Jeff Immelt took the company from, you know, about there to something, a fraction of that. He made lots of decisions. And, you know, I think a lot of the decisions, he made, were proved to be wrong. And, I think he has to live with that. He could have made other decisions, and, he didn't make other decisions. He made the decisions he made.
I'd say the last big question here, it seems like the GE story resonates and produces so many books every few years about it,
yeah,
because GE is really the emblematic company and industry, yeah, and set of industries of the 20th century. Would you say, this isn't asking you to say, like, what's a company that's like valued highly right now that's going to collapse like next week? That's not the question. The question is, do you see there being a similar company / industry in the 21st century that kind of fills the sort of the space in the American imagination regarding business? I mean, I could probably say it's tech. It would be tech, but it's hard to see, especially with the tech stocks kind of crashing, there being just one big GE-like player.
Well, GE was a conglomerate, right? It was heralded as a conglomerate. It was held up on a pedestal as a conglomerate. It was admired, you know, it was sort of the last of the great conglomerates. The conglomerate era was long over, and GE was still, chugging along beautifully.
And could you explain what a conglomerate is, to your point about the era being over?
Yeah, I mean, once upon a time, if you just sort of assembled under one roof a disparate collection of companies that you bought through the M&A process that basically had little or nothing to do with one another, like no synergies between them, but you just owned them to own them through some sort of holding company structure and allowed the CEOs of those companies to still run them and produce profits and do what they do, that the collection, the amalgam of those various companies under one roof, would somehow, you know, sprinkled with this incredible fairy dust of great management at the CEO level of this combined thing, would be very valuable and something, you know, worth doing. You know, their cost of capital would be lower. The sum of the parts would be greater than them individually. That was called the conglomerate era. And there were any number of quote-unquote conglomerates, you know, United Technologies, ITT, GE, Westinghouse. At one point, Westinghouse and GE looked very, very similar. You know, Westinghouse disappeared, 25 years before GE did? So GE was obviously able to, and by the way, you know, it was a living, breathing organism. I mean, Jack Welch bought a lot of companies, some good, some not good. He unwound some of the things that his predecessor did. Jeff Immelt came in and unwound a lot of the things that Jack did, for better or worse. I mean, one thing I discovered that was a total revelation to me, you know, and I had been a Wall Street investment banker for 17 years doing M&A. And so I was like attuned to this topic is, you know, I thought in 1986, when Jack spent like $6.4 billion, then the largest M&A deal of all time to that point, to buy RCA, itself another conglomerate, which owned NBC, that was sort of an innovation. Like Jack was saying, oh, I want to get into the media business. I think this is a, you know, Jack used to say, well, there's a moat around NBC because, you know, foreigners can't own NBC, can't own a television network. What I discovered is that actually, after World War I, Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt sort of forced GE to start what became RCA inside GE, because Wilson did not want the British to get a hold of GE's radio technology after World War I, which had proved so valuable during World War I. And he was afraid that the British, with Marconi, which was another company, would get a hold of this technology. And he didn't want them to get a hold of this technology take it from the Americans. So he forced GE to start RCA, what became RCA, inside of GE, with GE owning like 80% of it and Westinghouse owning 20% of it. And then basically, you know, 10 or 15 years later, the Justice Department, for reasons that were never really clear to me, forced GE to sell RCA and spin it off into its own separate public company. And that's what happened from like the early 1932 until 1986, when Jack Welch bought it back.
So for the last question, I know this is kind of unfair with a, you know, 700 plus page book, but to your point about this serving as a corporate autopsy, there's a dead body. I'm going to take that for the introduction. I like that articulation of it, but also to the Harvard Business School example, what would just be some, in no particular order, top line takeaways from this story that you'd want, let's say, a Harvard MBA to think about as they look at this story? It's also weird because, to your point, conglomerates are over. So there's no, like, don't buy RCA isn't quite the, isn't really an applicable lesson anymore either way.
Well, I think, you know, the main takeaway is the choice of the CEO is incredibly important. I mean, that's sort of like a truism, right? And so obvious, and yet the mistake gets made all the time. We just saw literally in the last few days. I mean, obviously, you know, Disney replacing Bob Iger, replacing Bob Chapek with Bob Iger, that's considered now, you know, that board made a mistake just 2 years ago. In fact, they re-upped his contract in June. They gave him a 3-year contract extension, backdated, so he had 2 years left on that contract in June. And then in November, they can him. Obviously, Jack Welch thought that Jeff Immelt was the wrong choice after Jack selected him. So the choice of the CEO, is very important. I mean, what's going on with the, you know, Twitter? I mean, that obviously Elon Musk bought it with most of his own money and appointed himself CEO and is in the process of destroying the company.
Well, so actually, here's another question then. What about boards then? Right? Because as we're talking about selection, we're talking about Elon, we're talking about Jack Welch picking Immelt. Are boards more absent than they should be in this process? Is this being so individualized a problem? What do you think about that? There's no more board at Twitter, obviously.
There's no board at Twitter. The previous board of Twitter, the public company, did a beautiful job, you know, selling the company for a high price. They had no choice. They had to do it. The GE board totally abdicated its responsibility under Jeff Immelt because you know, I think Jeff Immelt gets a lot of the blame for that because he, you know, anytime, going back to my point about not really being interested in dissent, anytime board members questioned what he was doing, he got rid of them. He got rid of Ken Langone, who Jack had appointed, because Ken Langone questioned him.
That's Home Depot CEO?
He was one of the founders of Home Depot. Yeah, okay. He wasn't private equity investor. Another board member was Sandy Warner, who was a CEO of JP Morgan when I was at JP Morgan and was on the GE board. And he questioned Jeff Immelt and sort of had a different vision for Jeff's, who Jeff's successor should be than Jeff did. And he, you know, kicked Sandy Warner off the board. So, I mean, that sends a very, you know, powerful message. You know, just like in Candide, Voltaire's Candide, you know, when he, you know, a general got shot, a British general got shot after losing a battle, you know, pour faire un exemple pour les autres. You know, nothing sends a more powerful message to the rest of the board that, you know, you're not interested in what they really have to say or dissent than eliminating board members who question what you're doing. So the board just totally abdicated its responsibility. And this is like what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to keep the CEO in check. They abdicated their responsibility. And then when I was, you know, doing my corporate autopsy, I would say about 98% of the board members that I contacted either completely ignored me, ghosted me, or you know, never even responded. So talk about further abdicating any responsibility. Some even have taken off GE, their time on GE's board from their resumes,
wow,
their LinkedIn pages, including the lead director of GE's board of directors during much of Jeff's tenure, Jack Brennan, who was the, you know, one-time CEO of Vanguard, you know, who's supposedly a huge money management operation as a fiduciary for investors, wouldn't even return my calls.
Well, I keep saying last question, but you keep saying interesting things. Why would someone return your call? Like, I always think about this, like, why would someone talk to you? Do you kind of like my inner PR person is like, don't talk to him. Why would you talk to him?
Yeah, you know, my wife asked the same question. Look, okay, there are people who don't talk to me. Nothing I can do about that. I don't have subpoena power. I find that some people who don't talk to me for the book, then the book comes out, then they call me up. Really? I literally just was contacted by Robert Nardelli, you know, who was the, you know, in the running to succeed Jack Welch, did not get selected, and then went to Home Depot and then Chrysler. I tried many times to talk to him and he wouldn't talk to me. Book comes out. He sees my op-ed in the Times yesterday and today he gets in touch with me. Ace Greenberg at Bear Stearns, the longtime senior partner slash CEO, you know, a senior partner at Bear Stearns, he wouldn't talk to me. Everybody else at Bear Stearns talked to me. He wouldn't talk to me. Book comes out, calls me up and says, let's go have lunch. And then says, I made a mistake. I should have talked to you. So I don't know, you know, so there are people who don't talk to me. There's nothing I can do about that. I don't have subpoena power. There are people who want to tell the truth about what happened because they feel it's important that that story get out there. Then it's going to be written. They want to, you know, it's going to be written anyway. They might as well, you know, people who actually care about the truth. I know this is quaint and, you know, kind of unprecedented these days, but there are people who actually care about that. And so they participate and they talk. And then there are the people who are just kind of vain and like seeing their name in print and like being the center of attention or like being included in the narrative and who are, you know, happy to share their stories. So, you know, I don't think, you know, I think there are more people in the middle category who just live through it, you know, believe a reputable, responsible person is going to write this story, and therefore it's going to be taken seriously when it comes out. And, you know, better to have that be the truth or as close to the truth as it possibly can be And one of the ways it's going to get to be as close to the truth as possibly can be is if, you know, I participate. And so they agree to participate.
I'll just close that as a third party, it seems that if you are able to personally get Jack Welch on the record, it's safe to talk to you. Because I think there's this debate about, like, should you talk to the press? You're not some random Twitter journalist slinging bad faith takes where there's nothing but downside. I think if you're able to get the folks that you can get, and I think approach the project the way you approached it, the advice would be to probably talk with you. William, this has been really, really great. I've really enjoyed this. The book is Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. It's a hefty read, but actually I'm gonna just continue, honestly, because I think it's cool to get a book that is both telling a story that is so sweeping that it also makes it mean deeper things for other stories when we look at. So thanks a lot for writing the book.
Well, thank you for having me and your intelligent and thoughtful questions. Made the time fly by. So thank you.
Good to hear. Thanks, William.
Take care.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.